The meaning of life, death, and resurrection. Once again, Baha'u'llah reveals the meaning of terms used in the holy books of former religions. Such terms as life, death, resurrection, the trumpet blast, paradise, and hell. He states, quote, "By the terms life and death spoken of in the scriptures is intended the life of faith and the death of unbelief. The generality of the people, owing to their failure to grasp the meaning of these words, rejected and despised the person of the manifestation, deprived themselves of the light of his divine guidance, and refused to follow the example of that immortal beauty." End quote. The day of resurrection, Baha'u'llah affirms, is ushered in through the advent of each manifestation of God. By his revelation, the faithful arise from the sepulchres of unbelief and acquire spiritual life. These are some of his words. Quote, "Such things have come to pass in the days of every manifestation of God. Even as Jesus said, ye must be born again. Again he saith, except a man be born of water and of the Spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the Spirit is spirit." The purport of these words is that whosoever in every dispensation is born of the Spirit and is quickened by the breath of the manifestation of holiness, he verily is of those that have attained unto life and resurrection, and have entered into the paradise of the love of God. And whosoever is not of them is condemned to death and deprivation, to the fire of unbelief, and to the wrath of God. In all the scriptures, the books, and chronicles, the sentence of death, of fire, of blindness, of want of understanding and hearing, hath been pronounced against those whose lips have tasted not the ethereal cup of true knowledge, and whose hearts have been deprived of the grace of the Holy Spirit in their day. Even as it hath been previously recorded, hearts have they with which they understand not. In another passage of the Gospel it is written, "And it came to pass that on a certain day the father of one of the disciples of Jesus had died. That disciple, reporting the death of his father unto Jesus, asked for leave to go and bury him. Whereupon Jesus, that essence of detachment, answered and said, Let the dead bury their dead." End quote. In the Quran, there are many references to the day when man will attain to the presence of God. This, Baha'u'llah affirms, can only be interpreted as attaining to the presence of the manifestation of God. Quote, "Attainment unto such presence is possible only in the day of resurrection, which is the day of the rise of God himself through his all-embracing revelation. This is the meaning of the day of resurrection, spoken of in all the scriptures, and announced unto all people. Reflect, can a more precious, a mightier, and more glorious day than this be conceived, so that man should willingly forego its grace and deprive himself of its bounties, which like unto vernal showers are raining from the heaven of mercy upon all mankind? Having thus conclusively demonstrated that no day is greater than this day, and no revelation more glorious than this revelation, and having set forth all these weighty and infallible proofs which no understanding mind can question, and no man of learning overlook, how can man possibly, through the idle contention of the people of doubt and fancy, deprive himself of such a bountiful grace? Have they not heard the well-known tradition? When the Qa'im riseth, that day is the day of resurrection. In like manner, the Imams, those unquenchable lights of divine guidance, have interpreted the verse, "What can such expect but that God should come down to them, overshadowed with clouds?" A sign which they have unquestionably regarded as one of the features of the day of resurrection, as referring to Qa'im and his manifestation. End quote.
The veil of knowledge. There are several references in the second part of the Kitab-e-Iran to the divine and religious leaders who taught their so-called learning have hindered the people from turning to the manifestations of God. These statements are similar to those made in the first part of the book, but now are mainly directed to the divines of Islam. 4. Acquired knowledge can become a veil between man and God. Referring to this veil, Baha'u'llah states, quote, "We have consumed this densest of all veils with the fire of the love of the Beloved." The veil referred to in the saying, "The most grievous of all veils is the veil of knowledge. Upon its ashes, we have reared the tabernacle of divine knowledge. We have driven from the human heart all else but him who is the desire of the world and glory therein. We cleave to no knowledge but his knowledge, and set our hearts on naught save the effulgent glories of his light." End quote. Recognition of the manifestation of God is not dependent upon acquired knowledge. In this regard, Baha'u'llah states, quote, "The understanding of his words and the comprehension of the utterances of the birds of heaven," meaning the manifestations of God, "are in no wise dependent upon human learning. They depend solely upon purity of heart, chastity of soul, and freedom of spirit. This is evidenced by those who today, though without a single letter of accepted standard of learning, are occupying the loftiest seats of knowledge, and the garden of their hearts is adorned through the showers of divine grace with the roses of wisdom and the tulips of understanding. Well is it with the sincere in heart for their share of the light of a mighty day." End quote.
The true seeker. One of the most illuminating of Baha'u'llah's utterances in the Kitab-e-Iqan is to be found in those passages concerning the qualities and attributes of a true seeker. These are his words as he addresses Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, the uncle of the Bab, quote, "But, O my brother, when a true seeker determines to take the step of search in the path leading to the knowledge of the Ancient of Days, he must, before all else, cleanse and purify his heart, which is the seat of the revelation of the inner mysteries of God, from the obscuring dust of all acquired knowledge and the illusions of the embodiments of satanic fancy. He must purge his breast, which is the sanctuary of the abiding love of the Beloved, of every defilement, and sanctify his soul from all that pertaineth to water and clay, from all shadowy and ephemeral attachments. He must so cleanse his heart that no remnant of either love or hate may linger therein, lest that love blindly incline him to error, or that hate repel him away from the truth. Even as thou dost witness in this day, how most of the people, because of such love and hate, are bereft of the immortal face, have strayed far from the embodiments of the divine mysteries, and shepherdless are roaming through the wilderness of oblivion and error. That seeker must, at all times, put his trust in God, must renounce the peoples of the earth, detach himself from the world of dust, and cleave unto him who is the Lord of lords. He must never seek to exalt himself above any one, must wash away from the tablet of his heart every trace of pride and vainglory, must cling unto patience and resignation, observe silence, and refrain from idle talk. For the tongue is a smoldering fire, and excess of speech a deadly poison. Material fire consumeth the body, whereas the fire of the tongue devoureth both heart and soul. The force of the former lasteth but for a time, while the effects of the latter endure a century. That seeker should also regard backbiting as grievous error and keep himself aloof from its dominion, inasmuch as backbiting quencheth the light of the heart and extinguisheth the life of the soul. He should be content with little and be freed from all inordinate desire. He should treasure the companionship of those that have renounced the world and regard avoidance of boastful and worldly people as a precious benefit. At the dawn of every day he should commune with God and with all his soul persevere in the quest of his beloved. He should consume every wayward thought with the flame of his loving mention, and with the swiftness of lightning pass by all else save him. He should succor the dispossessed, and never withhold his favor from the destitute. He should show kindness to animals, how much more unto his fellow man, to him who is endowed with the power of utterance. He should not hesitate to offer up his life for his beloved, nor allow the censure of the people to turn him away from the truth. He should not wish for others that which he doth not wish for himself, nor promise that which he doth not fulfill. With all his heart should the seeker avoid fellowship with evildoers and pray for the remission of their sins. He should forgive the sinful and never despise his low estate, for none knoweth what his own end shall be. How often hath a sinner at the hour of death attained to the essence of faith, and quaffing the immortal draught, hath taken his flight unto the celestial concourse. And how often hath a devout believer, at the hour of his soul's ascension, been so changed as to fall into the nethermost fire. Our purpose in revealing these convincing and weighty utterances is to impress upon the seeker that he should regard all else beside God as transient, and count all things save him who is the object of all adoration as utter nothingness. These are among the attributes of the exalted and constitute the hallmark of the spiritually minded. They have already been mentioned in connection with the requirements of the wayfarers that tread the path of positive knowledge. When the detached wayfarer and sincere seeker hath fulfilled these essential conditions, then and only then can he be called a true seeker. Whensoever he hath fulfilled the conditions implied in the verse, "Whoso maketh efforts for us," he shall enjoy the blessing conferred by the words, "In our ways shall we assuredly guide him." Only when the lamp of search, of earnest striving, of longing desire, of passionate devotion, of fervid love, of rapture and ecstasy is kindled within the seeker's heart, and the breeze of his loving kindness is wafted upon his soul, will the darkness of error be dispelled, the mists of doubts and misgivings be dissipated, and the light of knowledge and certitude envelop his being. At that hour will the mystic herald, bearing the joyful tidings of the Spirit, shine forth from the city of God, resplendent as the morn, and through the trumpet blast of knowledge will awaken the heart, the soul, and the spirit from the slumber of negligence. Then will the manifold favors and outpouring grace of the holy and everlasting Spirit confer such new life upon the seeker that he will find himself endowed with a new eye, a new ear, a new heart, and a new mind. He will contemplate the manifest signs of the universe and will penetrate the hidden mysteries of the soul. Gazing with the eye of God, he will perceive within every atom a door that leadeth him to the stations of absolute certitude. He will discover in all things the mysteries of divine revelation and the evidences of an everlasting manifestation. End quote.
Proof of the Bab's revelation. Having clarified these basic points for Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad as the eldest uncle of the Bab. Baha'u'llah then introduces proofs of the authenticity of the message of the Bab. Once again, he prepares the way by speaking generally about the manifestations of God, devoting several pages to clarify that the greatest proof of a prophet is his own self, just as the proof of the sun is the sun itself. Next in importance as a proof of the manifestation of God is the revelation of the Word of God. Baha'u'llah shows how Muhammad, on more than one occasion, pointed to the Quran as a proof of his mission. Quote, in the beginning of his book, he saith, no doubt is there about this book. It is a guidance unto the God-fearing. He, the divine being, and unknowable essence, hath himself testified that this book is, beyond all doubt and uncertainty, the guide of all mankind until the day of resurrection. In another passage, he likewise saith, and if ye be in doubt as to that which we have sent down to our servant, then produce a surah like it, and summon your witness beside God, if ye are men of truth. Behold, how lofty is the station, and how consummate the virtue of these verses, which he had declared to be his surest testimony, his infallible proof, the evidence of his all-subduing power, and a revelation of the potency of his will. Unquote. The study of the lives of the founders of all religions demonstrates that the Word of God is the most effective instrument by which the Prophet creates a new civilization. It penetrates into the hearts of people and becomes the spirit of the age. When a seeker recognizes the source of the revealed Word, he enters the city of certitude. Baha'u'llah affirms and he describes that city as, quote, none other than the Word of God revealed in every age and dispensation. In the days of Moses, it was the Pentateuch. In the days of Jesus, the Gospel. In the days of Muhammad, the Messenger of God, the Quran. In this day, the Bayan. And in the dispensation of him whom God will make manifest, his own book. The book unto which all the books of former dispensations must needs be referred, the book which standeth amongst them all transcendent and supreme. End quote. Concerning the revelation of the Bab, he writes as follows, quote, such bounty and revelation have been made manifest that the revealed verses seem as vernal showers raining from the clouds of the mercy of the All-Bountiful. The prophets endowed with constancy, whose loftiness and glory shine as the sun, were each honored with a book which all have seen and the verses of which have been duly ascertained. Whereas the verses which have rained from this cloud of divine mercy have been so abundant that none hath yet been able to estimate their number. A score of volumes are now available. How many still remain beyond our reach? How many have been plundered and have fallen into the hands of the enemy, the fate of which none knoweth? End quote. Because in the beginning of former dispensations, certain obscure souls embraced the faith of God, the learned belittled it and scorned its followers. Baha'u'llah points out how different was the situation when the Bab appeared. Quote, in this most resplendent dispensation, however, this most mighty, sovereignty, a number of illumined divines, of men of consummate learning, of doctors of mature wisdom, have attained unto his court, drunk the cup of his divine presence, and been invested with the honor of his most excellent favor. They have renounced for the sake of the beloved, the world, and all that is therein. We will mention the names of some of them, that perchance it may strengthen the faint-hearted and encourage the timorous. Among them was Mullah Hussein, who became the recipient of the effulgent glory of the Sun of Divine Revelation. But for him, God would not have been established upon the seat of his mercy, nor ascended the throne of eternal glory. Among them also was Sayyid Yahya, that unique and peerless figure of his age, and others well nigh 400 in number, whose names are all inscribed upon the guarded tablet of God. All these were guided by the light of that Sun of Divine Revelation, confessed and acknowledged his truth. Such was their faith that most of them renounced their substance and kindred and cleaved to the good pleasure of the All-Glorious. They laid down their lives for their well-beloved and surrendered their all in his path. End quote. Then follow passages of tribute by Baha'u'llah to the Bab as he describes his steadfastness in proclaiming his cause in the face of bitter opposition. Such steadfastness has characterized all the prophets of God and is yet another of their proofs. These are some of Baha'u'llah's statements about the Bab.
Quote, "Another proof and evidence of the truth of this revelation, which amongst all other proofs shineth as the sun, is the constancy of the eternal beauty in proclaiming the faith of God. Though young and tender of age, and though the cause he revealed was contrary to the desire of all the peoples of earth, both high and low, rich and poor, exalted and abased, king and subject, yet he arose and steadfastly proclaimed it. All have known and heard this. He was afraid of no one. He was regardless of consequences. Could such a thing be made manifest except through the power of divine revelation and the potency of God's invincible will? By the righteousness of God, were anyone to entertain so great a revelation in his heart, the thought of such a declaration would alone confound him. Were the hearts of all men to be crowded into his heart, he would still hesitate to venture upon so awful an enterprise. He could achieve it only by the permission of God, only if the channel of his heart were to be linked with the source of divine grace, and his soul be assured of the unfailing sustenance of the Almighty. Steadfastness in the faith is a sure testimony and a glorious evidence of the truth. And now consider how the Sadre of the Rezvan of God hath, in the prime of youth, risen to proclaim the cause of God. Behold what steadfastness that beauty of God hath revealed. The whole world rose to hinder him, yet it utterly failed. The more severe the persecution they inflicted on that Sadre of blessedness, the more his fervor increased, and the brighter burned the flame of his love. All this is evident, and none disputeth its truth. Finally, he surrendered his soul and winged his flight unto the realms above." End quote. As to the effect of the revelation of the Bab upon his followers, Baha'u'llah writes, quote, "And among the evidences of the truth of his manifestation were the ascendancy, the transcendent power and supremacy which he, the revealer of being and manifestation of the adored, hath unaided and alone revealed throughout the world. No sooner had that eternal beauty revealed himself in Shiraz in the year 60 and rent asunder the veil of concealment than the signs of the ascendancy, the might, the sovereignty and power emanating from that essence of essences and sea of seas were manifest in every land, so much so that from every city there appeared the signs, the evidences, the tokens, the testimonies of that divine luminary. How many were those pure and kindly hearts which faithfully reflected the light of that eternal sun? And how manifold the emanations of knowledge from that ocean of divine wisdom which encompassed all beings! In every city, all the divines and dignitaries rose to hinder and repress them, and girded up the loins of malice, of envy, and tyranny for their suppression. How great the number of those holy souls, those essences of justice, who accused of tyranny were put to death, and how many embodiments of purity, who showed forth naught but true knowledge and stainless deeds, suffered an agonizing death. Notwithstanding all this, each of these holy beings, up to his last moment, breathed the name of God and soared in the realm of submission and resignation. Such was the potency and transmuting influence which he exercised over them, that they ceased to cherish any desire but his will, and wedded their soul to his remembrance. End quote. It is important to realize that the Bab fulfilled prophecies recorded in the scriptures, particularly those of Islam. The revelation of the Bab had a special link with Islam. Not only was he himself descended from Muhammad, but his advent was also most eagerly anticipated by Muslims, both Shia and Sunni, and was considered the climax and the fruit of the faith of Islam. Muhammad and the holy Imams have left behind innumerable prophecies concerning the coming of the Promised One. All the circumstances of his revelation, the time, the place, and many other aspects of his cause are mentioned in the traditions of Islam, either explicitly or by allusion. Mirza Ahmad-e Azgandi, who became an ardent believer, was one of the most outstanding divines of Khorasan. Prior to the declaration of the Bab, he had felt the urge to compile all the prophecies and traditions of Islam connected with the advent of the Promised One. So vast is the scope of these prophecies that his compilation consisted of almost 12,000 traditions. The fulfillment of prophecies concerning the appearance of the Ga'im is of the utmost importance to Shia Islam. For over 1,000 years, its adherents had discussed these in their mosques, schools, and homes. It is perhaps for this reason that Baha'u'llah has devoted a few pages of the Kitab-e-Iqan to explaining some of these traditions. In doing so, he has demonstrated how the Bab has clearly fulfilled these prophecies.
Baha'u'llah anticipates his own revelation. In anticipation of his own revelation, while alluding to himself as the quintessence of truth, the inmost reality, the source of all light, and the king of divine might, Baha'u'llah addresses the leaders of the Babi community and the learned men in these words. Quote, "And now we beseech the people of the Bayan, all the learned, the sages, the divines, and witnesses amongst them, not to forget the wishes and admonitions revealed in their book. Let them at all times fix their gaze upon the essentials of his cause, lest when he, who is the quintessence of truth, the inmost reality of all things, the source of all light, is made manifest, they cling unto certain passages of the book and inflict upon him that which was inflicted in the dispensation of the Qur'an. For Verily, powerful is he, the King of divine might, to extinguish with one letter of his wondrous words the breath of life in the whole of the Bayan and the people thereof, and with one letter bestow upon them a new and everlasting life, and cause them to arise and speed out of the sepulchres of their vain and selfish desires. Take heed, and be watchful, and remember that all things have their consummation in belief in him, in attainment unto his day, and in the realization of his divine presence. End quote. In another passage, alluding to himself as the bird of heaven, he asserts, quote, "By God, this bird of heaven, now dwelling upon the dust, can beside these melodies utter a myriad songs, and is able, apart from these utterances, to unfold innumerable mysteries. Every single note of its unpronounced utterances is immeasurably exalted above all that had already been revealed, and immensely glorified beyond that which had streamed from his pen. Let the future disclose the hour when the bright of inner meaning will, as decreed by the will of God, hasten forth unveiled out of their mystic mansions and manifest themselves in the ancient realm of being." End quote. Yet, Baha'u'llah anticipates in some passages of the Kitab-e-Iqan the opposition he would meet and the sufferings he would endure at the hands of enemies from within the Babi community. Alluding to Mirza Yahya and those around him, Baha'u'llah writes, quote, "In these days, however, such odors of jealousy are diffused that I swear by the educator of all beings, visible and invisible, from the beginning of the foundation of the world, though it had no beginning until the present day, such malice, envy, and hate have in no wise appeared, nor will they ever be witnessed in the future. For a number of people who have never inhaled the fragrance of justice have raised the standard of sedition and have leagued themselves against us. On every side we witness the menace of their spears, and in all directions we recognize the shafts of their arrows. This, although we have never gloried in anything, nor did we seek preference over any soul. To everyone, we have been a most kindly companion, a most forbearing and affectionate friend. In the company of the poor, we have sought their fellowship, and amidst the exalted and learned, we have been submissive and resigned." End quote.
Baha'u'llah refers to his sufferings in many of his writings and makes clear that the greatest suffering inflicted upon the manifestation of God comes from those who profess his faith but are unfaithful to him. The pain which Baha'u'llah endured as a result of the unfaithfulness of Mirza Yahya, his insincerity and dishonorable behavior, was not physical. He felt this grief and anguish deep within his soul and states in the Kitab-e-Iqan, quote, "I swear by God, the one true God, grievous as have been the woes and sufferings which the hand of the enemy and the people of the book inflicted upon us, yet all these fade into utter nothingness when compared with that which hath befallen us at the hand of those who profess to be our friends." End quote. The authority with which Baha'u'llah speaks in the Kitab-e-Iqan, the tone of many of his remarks, and the allusions he makes to himself are all indicative of his divine station and his impending declaration. In one passage he states, quote, "The universe is pregnant with these manifold bounties, awaiting the hour when the effects of its unseen gifts will be made manifest in this world, when the languishing and sore athirst will attain the living kosar of their well-beloved, and the erring wanderer, lost in the wilds of remoteness and nothingness, will enter the tabernacle of life and attain reunion with his heart's desire." End quote. The Kitab-e-Iran is like an ocean. It contains the innermost reality of religion, and its depths are unfathomable. One may read it many times, yet each time new truths and new visions manifest themselves before the eye.
ای پسر حب، از تو تا رفرت امتناع قرب و صدره ارتفاع عشق قدمی فاصله، قدم اول بردار و قدم دیگر در عالم قدم گذار و در سرادق خلد وارد شو. پس بشنو آنچه از قلم از نزول یاد،
Among the writings of Baha'u'llah in this period, the hidden word stands out as a mighty charter for the salvation of the human soul. It shines as a beacon of light to men lost in the world of darkness and materialism. It gives light to their eyes, enabling them to see the path to their Lord. It also warns them of the many pitfalls on their way and extends a helping hand at every turn. The hidden word was revealed by Baha'u'llah about 1858 on the banks of the Tigris. In one of his tablets he states that certain of its passages were revealed on a single occasion and recorded in one tablet. The rest revealed at different times were later added to these. In the early days of the faith, this compilation was known as the Hidden Book of Fatime. Fatime was the daughter of Muhammad, the holiest and the most outstanding woman of the Islamic dispensation. At a young age, she married to Ali, the successor to Muhammad, and bore him several children, two of whom, Hassan and Hussein, succeeded their father to become the second and third imams, respectively, of the Shia sect of Islam. Fatime was a true and faithful believer and was much devoted to her father. His death plunged her into a state of bitter anguish and grief. According to the traditions of Shia Islam, the Holy Spirit, personified as the angel Gabriel, descended upon her and addressed certain words to her. These were dictated to Ali, her husband, and were revealed to bring consolation to her soul in her bereavement. She died soon after the passing of her illustrious father, the Prophet of Islam. Baha'u'llah has identified the hidden words with the verses which were revealed to Fatime. He characterizes it as the essence of, quote, "that which had descended from the realm of glory, uttered by the tongue of power and might, and revealed unto the prophets of old," unquote. This marvelous collection of heavenly counsels and admonitions can be described as a perfect guidebook for man on his journey to the spiritual worlds of God. The soul of man is not subject to the laws of nature as they operate in this physical world. Rather, it is animated, sustained, and governed by the operation of the great, the eternal covenant of God with man. The hidden words not only sets out the provisions of this universal and everlasting covenant which binds man to his Creator, but also demonstrates the way in which he can be faithful to it.
To understand the hidden words, one must appreciate the dual nature of man, namely, the association within him of two opposite forces, the spiritual and the physical, the soul and the body. The soul originates from the spiritual worlds of God. It is exalted above matter and the physical kingdom. The individual comes into being when the soul, emanating from these spiritual worlds, becomes associated with the embryo before birth. But this association is far above material relationship, such as egress and regress, entry or exit. Since the soul does not belong to the world of matter, the relationship is like that of light to a mirror. The light which appears in the mirror is not inside it. The radiance comes from a source outside. Similarly, the soul is not within the body. It has a special relationship to the body, and together they form the human being. But this relationship lasts only for the duration of mortal life. When that ceases, each returns to its origin, the body to the world of dust, and the soul to the spiritual worlds of God. Having emanated from the spiritual realms to become an individual being created in the image and likeness of God, and capable of acquiring divine qualities and heavenly attributes, the soul will, after its separation from the body, progress for all eternity. But the condition of the soul after death depends upon the extent to which it has acquired divine virtues in this life. If a child is born without a limb, he will never acquire it after birth and will remain handicapped as long as he lives. Similarly, the soul, if it does not turn to God in this life to become illumined with his guidance, will, though progressing, remain relatively deprived and in darkness. The soul can take with it only good qualities to the next world. It cannot take bad ones, for bad is only the absence of good, as poverty is the absence of riches. Therefore, an evil person is the soul poor in divine virtues. He carries with him only a small measure of heavenly qualities. But a man who has led a virtuous life in this world carries a much greater measure. Through the bounty of God, however, both these souls will progress, but each on its own level. In the next life, according to the teachings of Baha'u'llah, there are different degrees of existence, and, as in this life, those on lower levels will not be able to comprehend the attributes and qualities of the souls which dwell in higher realms. The highest station destined for man is to be illumined by the spirit of faith, which comes through recognition of the manifestation of God for the age, and through obedience to his commandments. To attain this station is the very purpose for which God created man.
The vision of man in mortal life is greatly restricted, like a prisoner in his cell who cannot see the vastness, the beauty, and the order of a boundless universe which surrounds him. Man is limited in his understanding of the spiritual worlds of God. His learning and knowledge, however deep, his intellect, however brilliant, cannot assure his comprehension of spiritual realities. Only through the recognition of Baha'u'llah in this day, and by turning to him, as a plant does to the sun, can the heart, the dawning place of the attributes of God, be illumined. It is then that man can understand the inner meaning of the utterances of Baha'u'llah and so be enlightened and drawn to God. Once the spirit of faith is born within the soul, it needs nourishment if it is to grow and mature. Again, the revelation of Baha'u'llah and His Word provide this food. By reading His words and meditating upon them and immersing himself in the ocean of His revelation, a man can develop spiritual qualities and his spiritual perceptiveness will grow day by day. His mind will become illumined, and even though he may be uneducated or illiterate, he is enabled to understand the inner spirit of the revelation of Baha'u'llah and to unravel the mysteries enshrined within it. When the soul attains the spirit of faith, it grows humble. Humility and self-effacement are the signs of spiritual growth, whereas pride in one's self and one's accomplishments is a deadly enemy. Because of its attachment to this world, the soul is not always illumined with the spirit of faith. In one of his tablets, Baha'u'llah, addressing his followers, has likened the soul of man to a bird. Quote, "Ye are even as a bird which soareth with the full force of its mighty wings and with complete and joyous confidence through the immensity of the heavens until, impelled to satisfy its hunger, it turneth longingly to the water and clay of the earth below it. And having been entrapped in the mesh of its desire, findeth itself impotent to resume its flight to the realms whence it came. Powerless to shake off the burden weighing on its solid wings, that bird, hitherto an inmate of the heavens, is now forced to seek a dwelling place upon the dust." End quote. The chief aim of Baha'u'llah in the hidden world is to detach man from this mortal world and to protect his soul from its greatest enemy himself. The hidden world provides a means by which, in the terms of the above analogy, the bird of the human heart can cleanse its wings from the defilements of this world and resume its flight into the realms of God. Attachment to this world can be described as anything which prevents the soul from drawing nearer to God. Baha'u'llah has taught that this world and all that is therein is created for the benefit of man. He is entitled to possess all the good things he can earn and enjoy all the legitimate pleasures that life bestows upon him. But at no time must he become attached to them. Baha'u'llah further teaches that man must take a great interest in this life, work for the betterment of this world, and assist in the building of a new world order for mankind.
In one of his tablets, Baha'u'llah has made the following remarks, quote, "Should a man wish to adorn himself with the ornaments of the earth, to wear its apparels or partake of the benefits it can bestow, no harm can befall him, if he alloweth nothing whatever to intervene between him and God. For God hath ordained every good thing, whether created in the heavens or in the earth, for such of his servants as truly believe in him. Eat ye, O people, of the good things which God hath allowed you, and deprive not yourselves from his wondrous bounties. Render thanks and praise unto him, and be of them that are truly thankful." End quote. On the other hand, Baha'u'llah has warned the rich in these words, quote, "O ye that pride yourselves on mortal riches, know ye in truth that wealth is a mighty barrier between the seeker and his desire, the lover and his beloved. The rich, but for a few, shall in no wise attain the court of his presence, nor enter the city of content and resignation. Well is it then with him who, being rich, is not hindered by his riches from the eternal kingdom, nor deprived by them of imperishable dominion. By the most great name, the splendor of such a wealthy man shall illuminate the dwellers of heaven, even as the sun enlightens the people of the earth." End quote. Whereas riches may become a mighty barrier between man and God, and rich people are often in great danger of attachment, yet people with small worldly possessions can also become attached to material things. The following Persian story of a king and a dervish illustrates this. Once there was a king who had many spiritual qualities and whose deeds were based on justice and loving kindness. He often envied the dervish who had renounced the world and appeared to be free from the cares of this material life, for he roamed the country, slept in any place when night fell, and chanted the praises of his Lord during the day. He lived in poverty, yet thought he owned the whole world. His only possessions were his clothes and a basket in which he carried the food donated by his well-wishers. The king was attracted to this way of life. Once he invited a well-known dervish to his palace, sat at his feet, and begged him for some lessons about detachment. The dervish was delighted with the invitation. He stayed a few days in the palace, and whenever the king was free, preached the virtues of a mendicant's life to him. At last the king was converted. One day, dressed in the garb of a poor man, he left his palace in the company of the dervish. They had walked together some distance when the dervish realized that he had left his basket behind in the palace. This disturbed him greatly, and informing the king that he could not go without his basket, he begged permission to return for it. But the king admonished him, saying that he himself had left behind his palaces, his wealth and power, whereas the dervish who had preached for a lifetime the virtues of detachment had at last been tested and was found to be attached to this world, his small basket. The possession of earthly goods is often misunderstood to be the only form of attachment, but this is not so. Man's pride in his accomplishments, his knowledge, his position, his popularity within society, and above all, his love for his own self, are some of the barriers which come between him and God. To rid oneself of these attachments is not easy. It can be a painful process, and may indeed prove to be a spiritual battle.
The hidden world can exert a potent influence in freeing man from the fetters of materialism and enabling him to win the battle against his own self. In a tablet to one of the teachers of the cause, Mirza Abbas, known as Qabil, a native of Abadi, Abdu'l-Bahá urged him to peruse the verses of the hidden words by day and night, and to supplicate God to enable him to carry out the exhortations of the Blessed Beauty. In the same tablet, he makes it clear that the hidden word is not merely to be read. Rather, it was given to the believers by Baha'u'llah to enable them to put into practice his counsels and commandments. Qabil's life of service and dedication is clearly indicative of a potent and transforming influence on his soul, partly derived from his chanting of some passages of the hidden word every day. He was a zealous and enthusiastic man, a poet of remarkable talent, a teacher of wide repute, and above all, devoted to Baha'u'llah.
He lived to old age after suffering many persecutions and spending much of his life in travel and teaching. He used to stay at home with his family only a few months each year. The rest of the time he traveled long distances on a donkey, riding from village to village and town to town. His enthusiastic spirit, coupled with his deep love for Baha'u'llah, cheered and uplifted the believers whom he met on his way. They would gather to meet him, and he would often request them, whenever circumstances permitted, to chant in unison certain tablets or poems of Baha'u'llah, which lent themselves to collective chanting, and would teach them to sing together some of his own beautiful, soul-stirring songs composed in praise and glorification of Baha'u'llah Abdul Baha or Shoghi Effendi. In those days, the playing of musical instruments was frowned upon by the Muslim clergy, and the Baha'is were careful not to upset a fanatical populace by playing them. But Qabil had a certain genius in clapping his hands to accompany their songs of love and praise. Where greater freedom prevailed, a homemade drum was a welcome accompaniment to his chant of love for Baha'u'llah. The believers, who were often oppressed and persecuted, always welcomed a few days that Qabil spent with them, for he created joy and enthusiasm wherever he went. Baha'u'llah has referred to the revelation of the hidden word in these terms. Quote, "The mystic and wondrous bride, hidden ere this beneath the veiling of utterance, hath now by the grace of God and his divine favor been made manifest even as the resplendent light shed by the beauty of the beloved. I bear witness, O friends, that the favor is complete, the argument fulfilled, the proof manifest, and the evidence established. Let it now be seen what your endeavors in the path of detachment will reveal. In this wise hath the divine favor been fully vouchsafed unto you and unto them that are in heaven and on earth. All praise be to God, the Lord of all worlds." End quote.
In this book, within the compass of a few pages, Baha'u'llah has given to humanity a prescription which safeguards its well-being and happiness. Speaking with the voice of God, he addresses man and exhorts him to possess a pure, kindly, and radiant heart. He stresses the importance of cleansing his heart, which is the dawning place of the revelation of God from the influences of the ungodly, calls on him to cast out the stranger, that the friend may enter his home, advises him not to seek fellowship with the ungodly, as this would turn the radiance of the heart into infernal fire, and assures him of the immortality of the soul. He also affirms that God has placed within him the essence of his light, which shall never be extinguished. He confidently asserts that God has made death a messenger of joy to man, establishes a covenant with him to love God, enjoins on him to cling to justice, forbearance, and love, reminds him that the healer of all his ills is remembrance of God, and describes the merits of turning to God in prayer at the hour of dawn. He counsels man to detach himself from this world, and not to abandon God's imperishable dominion for a fleeting sovereignty, rebukes him for his heedlessness, his indulgence of self and passion, directs him to avoid covetousness, envy, pride, and vainglory, declares that the tongue is designed for the mention of God, that it should not be defiled with detraction and backbiting, mentions that the best of men are they that earn a livelihood by their calling, and spend upon themselves and upon their kindred, for the love of God, denounces the idle and worthless souls who yield no fruit on earth as the basest of men, speaks of the greatness of his revelation, grieves that only a few souls have been found receptive to his call, and that of these few, only a handful hath been found with a pure heart and sanctified spirit. He warns man to withdraw his hand from tyranny, pledges not to forgive any man's injustice in this day, foreshadows an unforeseen calamity and a grievous retribution following man by reason of the deeds that he has committed, admonishes the rich to bestow their wealth upon the poor, states that wealth is a mighty barrier between the seeker and his desire, the lover and his beloved, exalts the station of a rich man who is detached from his wealth to such a position that his splendor shall illuminate the dwellers of heaven, even as the sun enlightens the people of the earth, urges everyone to show forth deeds that are pure and holy, and describes the powers latent within man in these words, quote, O Son of Spirit, I created thee rich. Why dost thou bring thyself down to poverty? Noble I made thee. Wherewith dost thou abase thyself? Out of the essence of knowledge I gave thee being. Why seekest thou enlightenment from anyone besides me? Out of the clay of love I molded thee. How dost thou busy thyself with another? Turn thy sight unto thyself, that thou mayest find me standing within thee, mighty, powerful, and self-subsisting. End quote.
There are a few passages in the hidden world which refer implicitly to the covenant of Baha'u'llah, a covenant which later became explicit with the revelation of the will and testament of Baha'u'llah, designated by him the Kitab-e Ahdi, meaning the Book of My Covenant. Abdu'l-Bahá, who is the center of the same covenant and the appointed interpreter of the words of Baha'u'llah, has explained the meaning of some of these passages. One instance is the following, quote, O my friends, have ye forgotten that true and radiant morn, when in those hallowed and blessed surroundings ye were all gathered in my presence beneath the shade of the tree of life, which is planted in the all-glorious paradise? Awe-struck, ye listened as I gave utterance to these three most holy words. O friends, prefer not your will to mine. Never desire that which I have not desired for you, and approach me not with lifeless hearts, defiled with worldly desires and cravings. Would ye but sanctify your souls, ye would at this present hour recall that place and those surroundings, and the truth of my utterance should be made evident unto all of you. End quote. The true and radiant morn, Abdu'l-Bahá stated, refers to the revelation of the Bab. The tree of life to Baha'u'llah, and the hallowed and blessed surroundings to the heart of the individual. He further explained that the gathering referred in this verse was not a physical but a spiritual one. The call of God was raised within the sanctuary of their hearts, but they did not respond and were bewildered and awestruck. In other tablets, Abdu'l-Bahá interpreted the meaning of the gathering beneath the shade of the tree of life as the establishment of the covenant of Baha'u'llah, the Lord, the All-Glorified, in the words of Abdu'l-Bahá, had beneath the shade of the tree of Anisa, meaning the tree of life, made a new covenant, and established a great testament. That this covenant was established at so early a stage in the ministry of Baha'u'llah is one of the mysteries of divine revelation. Indeed, in a tablet Abdu'l-Bahá stated that when the day star of the revelation of Baha'u'llah dawned upon humanity, the first ray which shed its light upon those gathered beneath the tree of life was that of the covenant of Baha'u'llah. Another passage in the Hidden Word which refers to this covenant is the following. Quote, O my friends, call ye to mind that covenant ye have entered into with me upon Mount Paran, situate within the hallowed precincts of Zaman. I have taken to witness the concourse on high and the dwellers in the city of eternity. Yet now none do I find faithful unto the covenant. Of a certainty, pride and rebellion have effaced it from the hearts in such wise that no trace thereof remaineth. Yet, knowing this, I waited and disclosed it not. End quote.
Abdu'l-Bahá has stated that the covenant upon Mount Paran refers to the covenant of Baha'u'llah, which was written by the exalted pen in the Holy Land and which was announced there after his ascension. Finally, the wings and the comb, mentioned in the following verse, are both interpreted by Abdu'l-Bahá as the covenant of Baha'u'llah. Quote, O son of desire, how long wilt thou soar in the realms of desire? Wings have I bestowed upon thee that thou mayest fly to the realms of mystic holiness, and not the regions of satanic fancy. The comb, too, have I given thee that thou mayest dress my raven locks, and not lacerate my throat. End quote. In the Hidden Words, Baha'u'llah has mentioned certain tablets, such as the fifth tablet of Paradise and the ruby tablet, together with certain lines from them. Abdu'l-Bahá has clearly indicated that none of these tablets or lines has been revealed in this world. They are preserved in the kingdom of God and in the realms of heaven. There is another passage in the Hidden Word which is of great significance, inasmuch as it reveals the nature and intensity of the revelation of Baha'u'llah and his exalted station. It is the following, quote, O Son of Justice, in the night season the beauty of the immortal being hath repaired from the emerald height of fidelity unto the Sadratul Montaha, and wept with such a weeping that the concourse on high and the dwellers of the realms above wailed at his lamenting. Whereupon there was asked, Why the wailing and weeping? He made reply, As bidden, I waited expectant upon the hill of faithfulness, yet inhaled not from them that dwell on earth the fragrance of fidelity. Then, summoned to return, I beheld, and lo, certain doves of holiness were sore tried within the claws of the dogs of earth. Thereupon the maid of heaven hastened forth, unveiled and resplendent from her mystic mansion, and asked of their names, and all were told but one. And when urged, the first letter thereof was uttered, whereupon the dwellers of the celestial chambers rushed forth out of their habitation of glory. And whilst the second letter was pronounced, they fell down one and all upon the dust. At that moment a voice was heard from the inmost shrine, Thus far and no farther. Verily we bear witness to that which they have done and now are doing. End quote.
Sadratul Muntaha in this passage literally means the tree beyond which there is no passing. The Arabs used to plant trees along certain roads, and the last tree indicating the end of the road
was known as Sadratul Muntaha. This term, which has been used by Baha'u'llah in many of his writings, is in one sense the symbol of the station of the manifestation of God, a station which is beyond the reach and understanding of men. The Maid of Heaven, in the writings of Baha'u'llah, is a symbolic term and assumes different meanings. He has used the Maid of Heaven to refer to himself or to one of the attributes of God and sometimes as the personification of the Most Great Spirit. The two letters mentioned in the above passage, according to Abdu'l-Bahá's interpretation, are B and H of the word Baha. The word Baha in Arabic is composed of three letters, B, H, and A. This means that only two letters out of three have been revealed in this dispensation, that the full significance and potency of the revelation of Baha'u'llah, which have been symbolically contained within the three letters of his name, have not been disclosed to mankind, and that only a limited measure of his light and glory has been shed upon humanity in this age. To this Baha'u'llah has testified in one of his tablets, quote, "Know verily that the veil hiding our countenance had not been completely lifted. We have revealed ourselves to a degree corresponding to the capacity of the people of our age. Should the ancient beauty be unveiled in the fullness of his glory, mortal eyes would be blinded by the dazzling intensity of his revelation." End quote.
O Son of Being, love me that I may love thee. If thou lovest me not, my love can in no wise reach thee. Know this, O servant.
O Son of Light, forget all save me and commune with my spirit. This is of the essence of my command. Therefore turn unto it.
O Son of Spirit, noble have I created thee, yet thou hast abased thyself. Rise then unto that for which thou wast created.
O Son of Man, breed not the sins of others so long as thou art thyself a sinner. Shouldst thou transgress this command, a curse wouldst thou be, and to this I bear witness.
O Son of Being, bring thyself to account each day ere thou art summoned to a reckoning, for death, unheralded, shall come upon thee, and thou shalt be called to give account for thy deeds.
O Son of the Supreme, I have made death a messenger of joy to thee. Wherefore dost thou grieve? I made the light to shed on thee its splendor. Why dost thou veil thyself therefrom?
O Son of Man, humble thyself before me, that I may graciously visit thee. Arise for the triumph of my cause, that while yet on earth thou mayest obtain the victory.
O my friend in word, ponder a while. Hast thou ever heard that friend and foe should abide in one heart? Cast out then the stranger, that the friend may enter his home.
O offspring of dust, be not content with the ease of a passing day, and deprive not thyself of everlasting rest. Barter not the garden of eternal delight for the dust heap of a mortal world. Up from thy prison, ascend unto the glorious meads above, and from thy mortal cage, wing thy flight unto the paradise of the placeless.
O son of dust, beware. Walk not with the ungodly, and seek not fellowship with him. For such companionship turneth the radiance of the heart into infernal fire.
O heedless ones, think not the secrets of hearts are hidden. Nay, know ye of a certainty that in clear characters they are engraved and are openly manifest in the holy presence.